bless these words in Jesus' name. I wanted to talk a little bit about apologetics simply because it's such a problem for believers. And specifically, apologetics as relates to science. We had, you know, Grace Sauer was doing the apologetics stuff this week, and those guys did a good job. But from what I hear, it was an interesting, good speakers. But some of the people that would call were very confused. And there's a lot of confusion, even in our ministry, among some people about science and the Bible. And did the Big Bang happen? Was there a gap? Was it an age or a day? Did we evolve? Maybe there was some evolution. Why not? You know, what's wrong with that? And so I'd like to talk just a little bit about some basic principles. We can't talk about any one thing at length because we don't have much time. But just some basic principles from a few different disciplines that we don't often consider. Now, today somebody called up and they said that the Big Bang doesn't really contradict the Bible, is if I understand. Now, I'm getting this secondhand. Something to that effect is what they said. That the Big Bang doesn't contradict the Bible. Well, yeah, it does. Not only is it that the Bible said that God created things, not a Big Bang. Not only did God say, for example, in Job, that He stretched out that heavens, and that and the Bible says that He put the stars in their courses, not a Big Bang. Okay, but also if you simply consider Genesis chapter 1 alone, we see that the Big Bang contradicts the Bible. Okay, how does it contradict the Bible? Well, in the most obvious way is that in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. People tend to think of this as, okay, in the beginning God created the universe and the earth. But that's not what it says. In the beginning God created the space that the universe is contained in and the earth. The universe did not exist until the fourth day. If the Big Bang happened, then Genesis 1 must be erroneous. Because the earth was formed first and the rest of the universe was formed 3 days later. And so, if there was a Big Bang, then the entire universe was somehow put out there through this eruptive event and gradually formed. But that's not how the Bible says it happened. The universe would have had to exist before the earth, and it certainly wouldn't have been a day. Okay? So we know that the Bible and the Big Bang do not get along. Now, to say that the Big Bang is not a contradiction of the Bible is to understand neither the Big Bang nor the Bible. Okay, it's an ignorance statement, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. It's just lack of understanding and knowledge. The Big Bang basically says that somewhere in the distant past, we don't know when, four forces came together. The forces are weak nuclear force, strong nuclear force. Those are the forces that hold atoms together. And then electromagnetic force and gravitational force. And those four forces somehow interacted, nobody knows quite how, to form a primordial particle that is smaller than an atom in size, in volume. And that primordial particle developed an instability in it, and that instability caused that primordial particle to essentially erupt into what is now the universe. Now, from a logic standpoint, that's difficult. From a physics standpoint, I think that would have to be considered impossible. Simply because of a few things, really. Number one, weak and strong nuclear forces, gravitational force, and electromagnetic force don't exist without matter being present. And so we cannot say that they created matter. Matter creates them. Okay, so we're putting the cart before the horse here. So unless there is matter, there are no such forces. So those forces cannot create matter. The second thing is that the exchange between particles, between atoms, between subatomic particles, is such that you can only bring them together to a certain extent. And if you try to force them together even more, you're going to actually force their separation. Because the repulsive forces between particles will take over. For example, positive charges do not attract. Positive charges repel. If you try to force positive charges together enough, you're going to actually force, by producing a great deal of potential energy, that potential energy will eventually turn into kinetic energy and force those particles apart. And so they're not going to hold together. That's what radioactive decay is. You have neutrons that have gotten together, somehow come together, but the forces that hold atoms together are not sufficient to actually hold the neutrons in place. The forces that are forcing those neutrons apart overwhelm the forces that hold them together, and thereby you have radioactive decay. Now, to say that all of the matter and energy that is present in the entirety of the universe could fit somehow into a volume that is smaller than an atom is really defying what we know about the way these forces operate. So we know that's not going to happen. That cannot happen unless there is something in physics. And this part is possible, that we have no idea of, whereby you can condense something beyond any imaginable or even calculable magnitude, then that's not going to happen. A black hole is not sufficient to do something like that. So we know that, well, can you imagine just taking a pencil and compacting it into something smaller than an atom? How big is an atom? You can fit millions of atoms on top of a pin. So the very sharp edge of the pin is millions of atoms. Something smaller than an atom, can you imagine it holding a pencil? Now, we are told that it held the entirety of all the mass and energy in the universe. That came out of that substance. That doesn't make any scientific sense. It doesn't make any common sense. So that's a serious problem from a scientific standpoint. Another major problem is the origin of the theory itself. The Big Bang Theory originated in the early part of the 1900s, but it was not yet established as the Big Bang Theory. There were some scientists that said that the stars, and at that time they didn't even know of the galaxies yet. Galaxies were really discovered in the early 1910s and 1920s. They really didn't know about galaxies yet. And so the idea was that all the celestial bodies were moving. And then when they discovered galaxies, they said, okay, all the galaxies are moving also. And a scientist, an astronomer named Edwin Hubble, who was from the opposite camp, who was saying that essentially the universe is static, that there may be some local motion, but not universal motion. And so Edwin Hubble took his telescope and he pointed it into the sky and looked at the different galaxies. And then he analyzed their color. And he found that all of the colors were shifted to the red side of the spectrum. And that, through the Doppler effect, tells us that the galaxies must be moving away, because as something moves away, its light waves appear to stretch out, and that gives it a shift to the red side of the spectrum. If something is moving toward you, it gives it a shift to the blue side of the spectrum, because the light waves will appear compressed. So in 1929, Edwin Hubble looks out into the cosmos, and he sees all these red galaxies. And that gives fuel to actually his opponents, his theoretical opponents. And so in the late 70s, the theory progressed to the point where the scientific community came and established the Big Bang as the official explanation for the formation of the universe. In 1986, Anthony Tyson went down to one of the most sophisticated observatories in the world, in Chile, in the Andes Mountains. Now, a 1986 sophisticated telescope versus a 1929 sophisticated telescope is a big difference. And Anthony Tyson asked the operator of the telescope, and he had devised some computer algorithms to help him with his analysis of what he saw. He asked the operator to point the telescope to a dark section of the cosmos. Now, telescope time is very expensive, so you don't waste your time with things you can't see. To an astronomer, dark is anathema. And so he was very unusual in this. So he asked them to point a telescope at a dark section of the universe because he had a theory. And it wasn't a theory pertaining to what he actually found in this regard. He did actually show his theory was correct, but this is kind of a secondary finding that I think was more important. Because when he looked out there, he found that it wasn't actually a dark section of the universe, it was a dim section of the universe. And he found what he called a wall of blue galaxies, what he called a curtain of blue galaxies. And he said, from our vantage point, we can see approximately 20 billion blue galaxies. Had scientists known this in the days of Edwin Hubble, the Big Bang theory would have never even been a thought. Because the evidence that has established it as a theory, on which the entire theory is based, has been completely shot. Because the notion was, since there are only red galaxies, everything in the universe is moving away from everything else. But now, with the presence of many blue galaxies out there, we know that that's not the case. And so, now, this is not suggesting that the universe is static, but it is suggesting that not everything is moving away from everything else. And now we know, in fact, that perhaps the universe is not expanding at all, perhaps it's contracting. And it does appear like there is contracting on a large scale of the universe, and the contracting is that the galaxies in their superclusters and clusters are moving closer to a huge supercluster of galaxies. Now, what does that mean? Galaxies are the basic unit of the universe. Galaxies are clustered into something called galactic clusters. Clusters are clustered into superclusters. So you have galaxies, clusters, and then clusters of clusters, which are called superclusters. There's a huge supercluster, monstrous in size, called the Great Attractor. And it appears that really all of these major galactic clusters and superclusters are all moving towards the Great Attractor. Some scientists speculate that the Great Attractor may in fact be the geographic center of the universe. Whether it is or not, it doesn't really matter. But there's an interesting little twist to this. I don't believe it's an accident. Where is the Great Attractor in relation to us? Well, we have to look through the disk to see the Great Attractor, through the galactic disk of the Milky Way. We'd have to look through the disk to do that. The only way we can see the Great Attractor is when we look directly through the Southern Cross. And so, I don't believe this is an accident. If you want to see the Great Attractor, look through the cross. So, we have this evidence that shows us that the very premise of the Big Bang Theory is inaccurate. Well, if a premise of a theory is inaccurate, the theory doesn't really hold much water. So, that's the Big Bang. Okay, it doesn't agree with the Bible, and it really doesn't agree with science. People still like it because they have no other alternative explanations. Now, we can also talk about how they suppose that the galaxies and stars and planets were formed out of coalescing dust. That's really not a good explanation. Okay, they say that dust particles came together with such force that they stuck. And then another dust particle comes in with such force and it sticks. And another dust particle comes in with such force and it sticks. That's a problematic theory. There may be a lot of dust on Earth, but there's not much dust in the universe. Actually, collectively, there's a huge amount of dust. But the vast spaces that are involved mean that the dust particles are incredible distances away from each other. And so, for those dust particles to find each other would be truly an unusual event. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is, there's nothing that says that after two dust particles have stuck and the third one comes in, that the third one won't knock the other two apart from each other. If you take let's say you take a stack of bowling balls, duck pins, so this wouldn't hurt you. And you have a stack of duck pin bowling balls, and you throw at the stack another bowling ball, it's not necessarily going to stick. The greater likelihood is that you're going to knock over the stack. And the stack that you had, all the ones that you had together, will now be separated. An additional factor is, how fast are the particles moving? Well, they may be moving quite fast, or they may not, relative to each other. They would have to be moving extraordinarily fast every time, because if they're not, then Isaac Newton's going to take over. You see, an object, when it exerts a force on another object, will have that same force exerted on it. And therefore, if you push against one dust particle, that dust particle pushes back. And it would actually tend to make things separate if the velocity was not sufficient to overcome those types of forces. So, there's a lot of problem. There's a great deal of problem in the way that the Big Bang explains the existence of the universe. Now, Andrew Lang, a PhD astronomer from Berkeley, had a very good comment, and we mentioned this the other day, I think, on the radio. He said, the universe that is and the universe that we explain are not the same universe. In other words, the universe that's portrayed by our theories and the universe that we can observe, those are not the same thing. What we observe doesn't line up with our theory. Well, if I'm a scientist who's looking at stars then observation is all I have. And so my theory needs to line up with what I've observed. And so to explain the universe with the Big Bang is simply a non-scientific explanation, because the theory does not hold up to the evidence. Now, let's go to evolution. There are some people who believe in the Christian community that maybe we could evolve. Maybe God could just send the whole thing in motion and we could just evolve. So God kind of like pushed the ball. And then as it rolled down the hill, it became bigger and bigger. And so let's look at that for a few moments. Evolution in itself is huge as an umbrella term. It incorporates certain concepts that are true and certain concepts that are not. Now, what we commonly think of as evolution is the notion that complex organisms such as ourselves evolved from simple organisms such as perhaps an amoeba. And they evolved from perhaps simple chemical structures. Now, there's a lot of problems with that. As a matter of fact, there's overwhelming quantities of problems with that. Okay, if we have, and this part is called chemical evolution, if we have evolved from what essentially started as a few basic chemicals, and they say it happened on the ocean floor over millions of years, that these chemicals somehow came together, perhaps out of the cosmos, amino acids, or possibly proteins somehow formed through the combination of different chemicals. And these chemicals came together over millions of years on the bottom of the ocean floor. And when they came together, lightning struck, somehow managed to develop a cell membrane around them, and then initiate evolutionary processes towards those chemicals. There is a fantastic tale. Yes, lightning strikes are very good for cell membranes. Yeah. They will give you a tan every time. Now, there's a problem with this, and there's a number of problems. Number one is, now they say that the chemicals were on the bottom of the ocean floor. For millions of years they were coming together. I want to know why they were never covered by sand. Because on the bottom of the ocean floor, you have a great deal of fluidity with the sand. And so sand, nothing lasts a long time before it gets covered by sand if it's on the bottom of the ocean floor. So why is it that over millions of years these chemicals were never separated by layers of deposition of the sediment? Now, we know that that does happen. We see it every day. Every time a kid digs up a fossil, he sees the evidence of this process taking place. And that's on the ground. That's not even talking about on the bottom of the ocean floor. Another problem is, what is the likelihood that you could actually develop a combination, or somehow get a combination of chemicals together like that, that they would have meaning? Now, if you take the average strand of DNA, and you cannot form DNA out of a protein. Okay? DNA is used to encode for proteins, but proteins cannot encode for DNA. And that's because of the way that the DNA is processed into RNA, and then RNA is used to make the protein. The process does not reverse from protein to DNA. It can reverse from RNA for a certain amount of time. But once the RNA is processed into something called messenger RNA, in other words, portions, non-coding portions of the DNA are removed, once that happens, you're not going to go back to DNA. Okay, now you're locked into it. a protein, which is then encoded for by RNA, cannot encode for DNA. The information is not there. But we're told that somehow you had proteins that somehow led to DNA. Well, that's not possible. The process doesn't work in that direction. Protein is not an information-carrying molecule. Protein is a structural molecule that was built using information. So what it is like saying is that if you look at a skyscraper, you can recreate the architect. Okay, a skyscraper cannot create an architect. An architect can only create a skyscraper. The process is not reversible. But we're essentially told that that's exactly what happened. Now, once that primordial protein somehow is supposed to have developed into something meaningful, where did the cell membrane come from? Cell membranes are very specific organic molecules with very specific alignments. If you could put them together, okay, fine. If somehow you could find yourself with enough phospholipids, or whatever they proposed that the cell membranes prehistorically would have been made of, okay, let's say you can do that. Nobody has ever found a way that that could have possibly happened, or even found a way to explain that. They just said somehow this happened. They figure somehow it happened, not because of evidence, but because, well, it must have. So somehow the cell membrane formed around the primordial protein or DNA or whatever it is that you had at that point. And now it started to function. The problem is that at a certain point, things are not just biochemical functions. Now, let's progress through the theory. Then the theory says that this very primordial, very basic, early living form then started to replicate into populations and evolved. Now, there's two major issues with that. How do you have life from non-living things? Now, if you kill something, all of the chemistry is still there, but it will not live. Scientists have taken all the components of a cell, put it together, and could not make it live. Why? Because it lacks something called teleonomy, the life force. Now, we know, and this is a problem that problem with this is that Christians know the principle to a degree, but don't actually know how to use the principle to defend the faith. We know that entropy or disorder is increasing. And evolution says that entropy actually diminished. And they will bring out the argument to a Christian who says, well, what about entropy? What about the increasing disorder? And they will be truthful to a degree in this, where they will say, if you bring energy from outside of the system into the system, then you can decrease entropy. And that is true. In other words, look, go to some ancient ruins. You can clean it up and rebuild it. Okay, that's energy from outside of the system being infused into the system to decrease entropy. A kid goes to clean their room. Same kind of a deal. Energy from outside the room comes into the room and decreases entropy. Okay? Now, by this, the evolutionists are showing that they don't really understand the crux of the matter. Entropy is also in the universe, and people sometimes use that as an argument against the Big Bang. That the Big Bang and the universe in general, disorder increases, not the other way around. Okay, and you know, then you get, well, if energy comes from outside the system, well, where from outside of the universe would you have brought in that energy? Well, the only thing I can think of that's outside of the universe that could bring in energy would be God, but we can't go there. But some people may say, well, there's evidence for a God who's set it all in motion, bang. Okay, well, that's a problem. Okay, here's the thing. How do you utilize the energy? In other words, having energy doesn't mean the energy is going to be utilized in a beneficial manner. Most often when energy comes in from an outside a system, you get heat. You want to warm your dinner, you're not going to build your dinner. You're going to heat your dinner. Take energy from outside the system and bring it into the system. Your dinner is dead. So it's not able to utilize that energy except to get warm. Okay, now, how does a living organism work? A living organism, let's say a plant, has the ability to take energy from outside the system to create order within itself. But that requires life. Okay, only life is able to take energy to form order. Nothing else has that ability. And so, if the primordial cell managed to arrange itself into greater and greater arrangements and organization and structure, I can understand where the energy could have potentially come from, maybe from sunlight, maybe from some sort of a hot spring, maybe from lightning, maybe from any number of sources. But that's not the issue. The question isn't where did it come from. The question is how did it get used? What was the teleonomy inside the cell that allowed that cell to utilize its energy? And if the cell did have teleonomy, where did the teleonomy come from? Yes, you do know. Well, the Bible tells us that teleonomy is the breath of God. The life force inside of living things was the breath that the Holy Spirit breathed upon all living things. So there's the teleonomy. The Bible tells us, right? The Bible tells us where the teleonomy came from. Science cannot account for teleonomy in the secular realm. Okay, so let's say that we could somehow make this thing alive. And let's say that, okay, it's able to utilize its energy, and now it can start evolving. There's a major, huge problem with that. Evolution, by its definition, requires reproduction. Well, evolution does not happen in individuals, according to the theory. Evolution only happens in populations. And it doesn't happen in one generation, it happens in the next generation. So, if evolutionary theory is true, then that primordial organism would have had to evolve very sophisticated reproductive mechanisms, because reproduction is sophisticated. It's not a simple process. It's a complex process. Even the simplest of reproductive processes is a complex process. So what they are saying is that a complex process evolved before evolution could take place. Because without that process, there is no such thing, according to the theory, as evolution. So how is it that an organism was able to reproduce in order to evolve? Well, now we have some serious problems, because the very mechanism of evolution had to evolve according to the theory. And without the mechanism, you don't have the process. So that's a problem. They don't offer an explanation for that. Okay. Then we are told that as evolution took place, information was added to the gene pool of populations. And once in a very rare event, so rare that it must have been extremely long periods of time between each one, one of those evolutionary occurrences called mutations somehow benefited the organism. Well, I don't even know if we have time enough to talk about mutations. But let's talk about them just briefly with one example of why mutations cannot be beneficial. We know that mutations happen. We know that in bacteria, an extremely simple, single-stranded nucleic acid organisms, mutations can benefit the organism by helping it to evade things like toxins from medications and things like that. One thing about that, though, is every virus that has mutated out of its attacking drug is still the same virus. The AIDS virus mutates out of drugs, but it's still AIDS. The flu virus can mutate, but it's still the flu. All of these bacteria and viruses that do mutate have not actually changed what they are. So that's one thought. But we're not viruses. We're talking about, if we're going to talk about evolution, it makes no sense to talk about the evolution of a bacterium when we have human beings and elephants and trees and all kinds of things, caterpillars and snails. And so why would we, say, okay, viruses are an example that evolution... No, tell me about the evolution of man or the evolution of my dog. So let's look at that. These are double-stranded nucleic acids. And that is a whole nother ballgame for numerous reasons, not only... For the reason that there are redundant mechanisms to prevent mutations. So somehow we have evolved the mechanisms to prevent evolution. And so if we look at what happens when something mutates. Now, DNA is where the mutations take place, and DNA is simply a chain, if you will, of letters. It's actually chemicals, but they're represented by letters. And the chemicals are A, T, C, and G, the letters, for adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, in an average human being, and even an unusual human being. And so, let's change, for the sake of the discussion, let's change the letters. Okay, I actually was going to use this on Grace Hour, and I wrote it down, but I don't know if I still have this example, because it's a good example. And if I don't, that's okay. I do. Let's say that we use the letters S-E-R-U instead of A-T-C-G. Now, the letters, the way they arrange into what's essentially three-letter words. Okay, those are called codons. So every three letters makes a codon, which, if it was a spoken language, would be the equivalent of a word. So DNA is a four-letter alphabet filled with three-letter words. Okay? Now, let's use S-E-R-U and form three-letter words. Okay? What can we form? See, Sue, run. Okay? We've got nine letters forming three words. Let's repeat it. We have nine letters forming three words. See, Sue, Ru. Okay? So we have nine letters that make up a sentence. The sentence has meaning. See, Sue, Ru. Okay? And let's say we say that sentence twice. We can say it as many times as we like. And DNA can repeat as many times as it likes. Okay, well, so to speak. So let's say we have Sisuru, Sisuru. Now, so long as our letters, as our words start the way that we divide the triplets of letters to form our words, so long as that triplet starts with the first S, we have the sentence sisu ru. Now, if we don't start with the S, if we start with the E, then we have the sentence is ur uns or uz. Okay, so we have is ur uz. But if we start with the second E, we have esu eru isi. Now, that's important, and I'll explain to you why. If you're going to have a mutation, it has to be beneficial, it must not be detrimental, in order to be evolutionarily sustainable. Only beneficial mutations, according to the theory, will evolve into new information in the gene pool. New information will then be reflected in some sort of a new structure or perhaps physiological process or something like that. And it has to give the organism a benefit. So if we're going to have evolution taking place, we need these beneficial mutations. If there is one harmful one, then that's going to be eliminated. Now, why I say that is this. There is something called the rule of threes. And that says that there is no such thing as a mutation that will give three beneficial outcomes. Okay? Now, you can have two beneficial outcomes, but you can't have three. Now, that was used when they started making a new treatment for AIDS. Back in the 80s, if you got AIDS, you were pretty much done. And then a graduate student at Johns Hopkins University Medical School applied this rule of threes. The problem with AIDS was that every time you came up with a new medication, the virus would immediately mutate out of the effect of the medication. This graduate student, I don't remember his name, but he came up with the notion, what if you don't use one medication, what if you do three? Because nothing can have a mutation that has three benefits. One of them is going to be a detriment. And so, he said, they started treating it with three medications at a time, and now even more, and they call it the AIDS cocktail. And the idea is that if the AIDS virus mutates against one of the medications in the cocktail, there's still two others. If it mutates against two of them, there's still another. But it's not capable of mutating against all three of them. And so, the rule of threes was used, and now AIDS, although obviously a nasty disease, is no longer the killer it used to be. AIDS used to be a fairly quick death sentence. And that's no longer the case. And so, we know that if you have three things that are affected by a mutation, one of them will not be good. Now, all genes work with at least two other genes. The minimum thing is three genes working together. No gene works alone. If you have a mutation in one gene, you are at least affecting the function of three genes. Let me give you an example. Eye color. You have a gene that says brown eyes. You have a gene that says there will be color. You have a gene that allows the production of the color. Okay, three genes. Okay, there's no such thing as a gene that works with less than two other genes. So, if you mutate one of them, you affect all three of them. Now, the other thing is that, let's go back to our sentence, sisuru. Sisuru doesn't have a whole lot of meaning if you change which letter it starts at in the English language. So if we say something like esu eru isi, that doesn't mean anything in English. In the early 2000s, or just prior, in the late 1990s, I don't remember exactly where, scientists, and this was written up in the Journal of the Cell, scientists found that there are organisms, and we are believed to be among them, the last I heard, where all three sentences have real meaning. In other words, in the analogy, sisuru would have meaning, as would is or us, as would esu eru isi. And all three of those would be meaningful sentences. What does that mean? That means that when I have a series of triplets called codons, that those codons identify amino acids, and the order of those codons determines the protein that's formed from them. If I change what's called the reading frame by changing which letter goes first, and thereby I change the triplets, I change the protein that's manufactured, but it's still a meaningful protein. If I change the frame again, I get yet another meaningful protein. So each three letters, or let's say we have a set of these codons, each set of codons incorporates or encodes for three different proteins. Change one letter and you've changed altogether 9 genes. Because no one gene works alone, and because each, no matter what letter I start with in the codon, each reading frame is meaningful. And so I've changed a great deal. I haven't just changed three. I've changed way more than that. All I needed to do was make it a three, and it would have really wiped out the process. So the notion that a mutation can lead to a benefit, we know is not true. Mutations can have one of two results. They can be neutral, blue eyes to green eyes, who really cares? Or they're negative, healthy to cancer, healthy to Huntington's chorea, healthy to whatever number of genetic diseases. So we know that these mutations are not capable of becoming positive. Now, there's actually a lot of evidence directly involving evolution, but we'd really be here for the next few weeks if we were going to discuss all of it. But we're just going to talk about that one bit. In a nutshell, if that's a little bit confusing, think of it this way. You have an equilateral triangle. Okay, all three sides are exactly the same length. Put a dot in the middle of the triangle. Now, move the dot, not the triangle, without changing the triangle, move the dot so that it moves closer to all three corners. You can't do it. Okay, that is the problem with the notion that we have evolved. The mechanism that's proposed is not capable of the function that it's supposed to have resulted in. So, did we evolve? No, it's not possible. It's not possible to have evolved. Now, scientists will use the other end of evolution, microevolution, as evidence for what is macroevolution. Macroevolution, amoeba to man. Microevolution is different. Microevolution, and this does happen, but it's a very important distinction to make. Many evolutionists that I know, if I start talking about macroevolution, they get very mad at me. They don't want to hear it. Because at this point, they leave science and simply go into reaction. Microevolution says that because of natural forces, information is eliminated from the gene pool, not introduced. We know that this takes place. Okay, one example is the peppered moth that was in industrial England. Okay, you had the peppered moth that came in two varieties, a gray color and a white speckled color. Okay, the white speckled color used to be almost everywhere. There were some gray colored ones, but they weren't really all that common. And the white speckled ones, there were so many of them that the food and the other resources that the peppered moths depended on, just because there were so few white speckled moths, gray colored moths, they were starting to basically get wiped out, because the what they needed was being taken away from them by the other moths. Now, in the industrial age, factories started polluting. And they would burn coal and whatever, and you'd have soot on wood, on the trees, on the bark. And all of a sudden, when a gray-colored moth landed on the bark, it hid in the soot perfectly. The result of that was that the predator of the peppered moth, which was a bird, could not find the gray-colored moths. On the other hand, the white speckled moths stood out against the soot, and therefore birds could find those moths very easily. And all of a sudden, the predators started wiping out the white speckled moths, because an outside force came and created an environment whereby it favored the gray color. Eventually, information was taken out of the gene pool of the speckled moth for the white, or for the peppered moth, for the white speckled color. So information was not added to the gene pool. Information was that used to be in the gene pool was eliminated from the population. That's microevolution. Microevolution works on the principle of natural selection. Natural selection, many Christians react at it, but it's true. And it's not a difficult theory. Natural selection says that an organism is capable of surviving in its environment according to the physical and behavioral attributes that it possesses for that environment. What does that mean? My favorite example, skinny little naked guy in Alaska is not going to do well. Skinny little naked guy in Hawaii is going to be a happy camper. Okay, that's natural selection. Get an environment that's hostile to the physical ability that I have, and my likelihood of survival diminishes greatly. Adaptation is simply how fit I am, or how well equipped I am for my environment. Fitness is, in my environment, how well do I outcompete members of my own species for food and mates. These are all things that do function as a force in microevolution, in eliminating information that was present in the gene pool and taking it out. It's not the increase of information, it's the decrease of information. Huge difference. Macroevolution says that information was increased and thereby a simple organism became complex. Microevolution says that information decreases and thereby the variety within a population of a given species diminishes, not the actual species. What do I mean by variety? Blonde hair, red hair, brown hair. Okay, that's variety. It doesn't eliminate hair. It eliminates hair, perhaps a specific hair color. All right, that would be how natural selection works. Anyway, one last thing, and then we're going to be finished. And we're only going to take like 2 minutes, 3 minutes with this. The concept of time. Time is hugely problematic for the evolutionist, more so than for the creationist. The reason why time is problematic, and again, I don't have enough time to go into this very thoroughly, and I don't actually even have time to go into the strongest of the evidence.
Time is so problematic.
It is problematic, isn't it? Time doesn't actually exist as an entity in itself. It is a byproduct of velocity. And the time dilation equation, which unfortunately we don't have enough of that time, the time dilation equation, which I won't really go into, shows us this. But you can find it in any basic college physics textbook. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's the Lorentz equation. I use time dilation because Lorentz equation has different expressions, and that might become confusing if somebody's listening on the internet. But time dilation is one expression of it. Now, the time dilation equation shows us that time requires two frames of reference of observation in order to exist. One we say is stationary, one we say is in motion. Now, without those two frames of reference, time is not definable. When people say that the Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago and the universe approximately 15 billion years ago, they say actually anywhere between 10 and 20 billion years, so a mere 10 billion year difference. When people say that, they're actually using words with no meaning. It's called babble. Okay. Why is it that they have no meaning? Because without two frames of reference, time is not definable. In other words, it doesn't exist. It's a byproduct of velocity that requires two frames of reference. If the Earth did not exist, where were the frames of reference? In other words, whose clock are we using? Okay, I think somebody actually did ask that question, right? According to whose clock? That's a good question, because you need two frames of reference to define time. We define time by two things. We actually use two standards of time. We use the standard of time, the outside, the perimeter of the Earth versus the axis, and there are two frames of reference that define our hours and minutes. Then we also use a second one that defines our days and really our months and years, weeks, months, years, which would be the Earth and the Sun. Okay, so our relative position to the Sun will determine where along we are in the week, in the month, in the year, and so on. So we have two sets of frames of reference. But prior to the existence of the Earth, in the solar system, and evolutionary cosmologists all say that the Earth and the solar system were formed at the same time, what are our frames of reference? Now here's the problem. If the motion changes, the passage of time changes. It's not that it's longer or shorter. It's different. If somebody can enter into those what's called inertial frames of reference, in other words, the changes of the frame of reference of motion, they won't experience anything different from one to another. But the clock will. So and this has been tested, by the way. This has been tested by Hegel and Keating in 1976, and it held up. The way that we move, even the direction in which we move, changes how time passes. So to say that the Earth is very old, it's problematic. To say that the universe is older than the Earth is even more problematic. Now, why is it problematic to say that the Earth is old? Because of things like the decrease of the diameter of the Sun, which is shrinking every 5 feet every hour. Because of things like the amount of helium that's in the atmosphere. Helium cannot leave the atmosphere, so all the helium that radioactive decay has ever poured into the atmosphere is still present. in the 1950s, the Nobel laureate Melvin Cook had gotten a handle. He was a physical chemist. He figured out how to measure the amount of helium in the atmosphere along with the average rate of decay that would pour the helium back into out into the atmosphere. And he measured an age limit for the Earth as 10,000 years. There's not enough helium. And since the gas can't leave the gravitational pull of the planet, it's a fairly reasonable way to look at things. We can't lose it. It's not going anywhere. Nobody ingests it. Nobody breathes it. It's a noble gas. It's not reacting with anything. So it's just sitting there. As far as the sun goes, it's shrinking 5 feet per hour. Okay, what does that mean? We know we've been measuring the size of the sun for the last 400 years. We know on average it shrinks 5 feet per hour. That means a million years ago the planet would have been a desert. 25 million years ago, because nobody is thinking that the rotation or the revolution of the Earth around the sun, that the orbit is changing at all. It's staying generally the same. Some variety, but not enough to say it's changing. It's staying the same, so we know that the sun would have been coming out towards the Earth. Okay, 25 million years ago, the face of the sun would have been touching the face of the Earth. 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth would have been somewhere within the sun. The sun would have had to have been a nuclear star in order to be able to actually sustain that. Not happening. There's a lot of evidence. There's a lot more evidence than what I gave you. There's a great deal of evidence. We just don't have enough time to talk about it tonight.